is Seeger and others against AFNI Incorporated. Mr. Hannes?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm David Hannes, and I represent the defendant appellant, AFNI, Inc. The case at bar is an action for alleged violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which prohibits, among other things, debt collectors from collecting any amount, including interest, fees, or charges, or other expenses incidental to the principal obligation, unless such amount is either expressly permitted by the agreement creating the debt or authorized by law. In this case, the plaintiffs allege that AFNI is the assignee of certain debts for unpaid cell phone bills originally owed by the plaintiffs to Singular Wireless, violated 1692F1 by sending them collection letters that included a fee for collection in addition to the principal debt.
Let me ask you something that has bothered me about the briefs in this case. You know, I can certainly see the language, the various modifications on this contract language, but it seems to me that there are two ways that a company like Singular could handle its portfolio of bad debts. One of them is it could hire a collection agency to go out and collect those debts and pay a fee to that collection agency. It's holding the debt, but the collection agency is performing a service for it. And in that instance, the language in your contract clearly shows that the customer is agreeing to pay those fees. The other thing that people often do is you will sell or assign that portfolio of debt at a discounted rate to a company, perhaps like AFNI, and you don't sell it for 100 cents in the dollar. You sell it for some discounted rate so that the risk of collection is transferred now over to the assignee or the purchaser of the debt, and they will collect some of them presumably in full, and they won't collect some of them at all, and they compensate themselves essentially by the discount rate. And the premise of your argument is that these are two identical transactions, but it seems to me that what happened in this case is the second of those. And as assignee, you stand in the shoes of the assignor, and there aren't any the economic structure is not a fee structure. It's a discount structure.
Your Honor, I think with regard to 1692F1, there are really two prongs. The collection of a fee can be either authorized by the agreement creating the debt, or in the alternative, permitted by law. And I think Your Honor's comments go to the first prong.
Well, I'm looking at the contract first because certainly that's one of the arguments that you've made. And I don't see anything in this contract that authorizes fee collection under the structure of the transaction you had. If Singular had simply hired your company. Maybe your company does this sometimes, I don't know. But if Singular had simply hired your company to go out and collect the debt and you had said, here's our fee, you know, our fee is 15% of the amount that we're collecting, then Singular would be able to to reimburse itself for that money that it spent.
Your Honor,
that's not what happened here.
I think looking at the contract, there are a couple of different ways to understand that contractual language. One may be that generally, if any party other than Singular winds up with this debt for collection purposes, that may trigger the obligation to pay costs and fees. And yes, well,
you're agreeing to. I mean, I'm looking. This is just one of the places this appears in this record. But on page 4 of your brief, you've set out the beginning of your statement of facts, some of the different variations. Mm-hmm. You agree to pay Singular the fees of any collection agency. Well, if you've just purchased the debt at a discount, you don't have fees. You are the purchaser of the debt.
I understand the point, Your Honor, but I think there are
it's
two.
It's not a contractual thing. Maybe you better make your argument about under law.
Very well. I think if I can distill AFNI's appeal to its essence, it's this. And that's that I think this is one of those rare circumstances where I believe the district court overlooked a key affidavit submitted by AFNI in opposition to the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, which at minimum created a disputed question of material fact, precluding summary judgment for the plaintiffs under the permitted by law prong of 1692F1, as well as the bona fide error defense under 1692K.
Mr. Hess's affidavit strikes me as incredibly vague, and it's very hard for me to see that some kind of generic statement that 15% is, you know, about our average cost, or, you know, below the industry average or something, how that has anything to do with actual costs of collection of particular debts, especially since it's a percentage, not a flat fee. You know, the question I would ask is, if that were the only evidence in the record, would that be enough to get you to a jury? And I'm thinking it would not.
I believe that it is, Your Honor, for the reason that under the Freiermuth and Tuttle cases cited in our brief, a fee may be, an additional fee may be permitted by law if state law would permit the recovery of either incidental or consequential damages incident to a breach of contract.
But this is quite different from Tuttle. Tuttle, it's $20. Equifax is charging $20 per dishonored check, and Equifax actually takes over the checks, whereas you've got a percentage. So you charge Seeger $15.87. You charge McLean, not to be confused with McCain, $190.39. There's no evidence in this record to show that your collection costs vary by the amount of the debt.
Your Honor, if I can respond to that. In Tuttle versus Equifax, the fee in question was a $20
per check fee.
And the
flat fee per check. It doesn't matter if the check was written for $5,000 or $20.50. It was a flat $20 fee.
That's correct. And the second circuit commented specifically that the statute permitted Equifax to impose its service charge. Equifax, pursuant to its agreement with Richland, authorized Richland to accept Tuttle's check as payment for the goods. Then after Tuttle's check was dishonored, Equifax took it from Richland at face value. And I think that the pertinent language of the court's decision is that Equifax's service charge constitutes incidental damages to the extent that it offsets the collection expenses arising from the dishonored check. And the court goes on to say that Equifax has offered evidence to show that its collection costs, on average, are slightly in excess of $20 per dishonored check. It was therefore within the province of the jury to find that the $20 service charge was
commercial. Is that regarded as a credit transaction, the bad check situation?
It was a transaction involving the return of a dishonored check.
And I don't know. Was that classified as a credit transaction? This transaction here was not.
Your Honor, I don't know that it the classification as a consumer credit transaction made a difference to the in the Tuttle versus Equifax.
Well, let me ask you another question. You're arguing here that you're entitled to collect 15% because of the costs of collection, but you didn't. That was not your argument in the trial court.
Indeed, we
did. You're making a new argument here, right?
No, Your Honor. Indeed, we did raise the issue that AFNI's collection fee was permitted by law. We specifically cited the Freiermuth and Tuttle cases, and in fact, the district court, in its decision granting summary judgment,
well, I think you only threw it at the end of your reply brief or something. That was not your principal argument in the trial court.
It was certainly an argument that we raised and as to which the district court specifically responded in its memorandum decision granting summary judgment for the plaintiffs. And I think the language in the Tuttle versus Equifax case, to the effect that Equifax offered evidence to show that its collection costs on average are slightly in excess of the $20 dishonored check fee, is precisely the same type of evidence or language set forth in Mr. Hess's affidavit, to the effect that AFNI's 15% fee was substantially less than its average cost of collection. Same evidence in Tuttle created a question of fact for the jury on the reasonableness of the collection fee.
Would you remind me where in the district court? The district court wrote a really long opinion, so I'm just flipping around here where an explicit discussion of the Hess. Because you're very critical to the district court for ignoring what Mr. Hess said,
and now you're saying,
on the other hand, well, he talks about it, so I don't know.
Precisely my point, Your Honor, the trial court addressed the permitted by law prong of 1692 F1 at some length without commenting at all on Mr. Hess's affidavit or the impact.
As Judge Cuddy is saying, maybe that has something to do with the way you introduced it into the record.
I think that there was an extensive discussion in the trial court's memorandum decision, starting at page 32. It's specifically subtitled "Permitted by Law," and the trial court offers a very long discussion in response to AFNI's argument that the fee was permitted by law under Freiermuth and Tuttle.
And what you're saying, what your argument there was, which is a lot different from what you're now saying, was that the fact that contract law permits the recovery of incidental damages was what allowed you to do this. And you were citing these UCC cases, and you were citing all sorts of other analogous things. What you're not saying is, here's our evidence of our collection costs. And I'm not sure that this ballpark average figure, again, is just so general.
I think it definitely tracks with the evidence that the Tuttle court found
Maybe so. Anyway, you're in your rebuttal time if you want to save anything.
I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mather.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Corey Mather, and I represent the plaintiff appellees Marvin Seeger, Joanne Blarick, Bradley Gamroth, Robert McLean, and a certified class of similarly situated consumers in this case.
So maybe you should start with the Hess affidavit and tell us why this isn't evidence. It certainly costs companies money to collect debts. You've got to have, they have these computer systems, and you've got to contact people, and, it's an office operation. So what's wrong with this fee?
Well, there are several things wrong with, in this particular case, in AFNI's 15% fee and their attempt to support it now with Mr. Hess's affidavit. First, the one thing relates back to the nature of the relationship, which AFNI acquired this debt, and that it was at a discount rate, not at a they weren't being paid on a fee basis as a debt collector.
Is there the record about exactly how they acquired the debt? Do we know at what discount, if any? I'm assuming it was at a discount because I'd be stunned otherwise, but I don't know.
Specific amount on the dollar, whether it be a dollar on the dollar or one penny or somewhere in between, I don't believe is in the record. I would assume that AFNI would contend that's proprietary information and probably would have objected to that being unnecessarily in the record, a specific amount. But the fact that they have this, the testimony in Mr. Hess's deposition that was cited in AFNI's appellate brief is frankly taken out of context when it's now trying to be shown about their computer systems and the costs, and then that now is just that's 15% of these debts, which, as the court accurately notes, just amongst the four consumers who are class members in this case, are class representatives in this case, varies between $16 and about $190. But all of those costs are frankly overhead or sunk costs as part of AFNI's business operation as a debt collector.
Too variable by the amount of the debt.
Certainly not, and they have nothing to do with with what is now appears to be the primary argument about incidental or consequential damages. They don't have to do with these breaches or these alleged breaches of the consumers on these cellular service contracts, and they also show that they're going to be that. Other cases in other courts that have looked at least somewhat similar circumstances where there's a service or collection fee or something, if there's a uniformity to that fee and the amount because of the process is the same in their efforts to collect, well, that makes some sense, and that would essentially be what Tuttle is about in contrast with this case.
Okay.
So I would also, if I may, while we're on the subject of the Hess affidavit, as the court was correct to note that there's really been, a sea change in the importance in which the Hess affidavit has been put forth by AFNI to support the claims, and now essentially it's a do everything factual evidentiary piece being put forward to say that there's a jury question because there's 15% costs and that supports either paying itself pursuant to the contracts or incidental consequential damages or some other permitted by law problem.
Let me ask you this question. I mean, what AFNI is, I believe, trying to rely on the Hess statement for is to show that there is some evidence in the record that would support a finding that this 15% fee represents its actual cost of collection, because even the district court recognizes that actual cost of collection is something that might be a legitimate item of recovery. And my question for you is, who has the burden of bringing that kind of evidence in? It seems to me their argument implicitly is that you had the burden, at least once the Hess affidavit is there, to come back and say, no, that's actually not really good evidence of actual cost. Is it their burden to show, or is it yours?
Well, initially, the plaintiffs have the initial burden of proof in this case. Having put at summary judgment, having put forward that affidavit in response to the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, I would say that there are several reasons why this affidavit that we're talking about here at length now and brought up really at length in AFNI's appellate reply brief, there are multiple reasons why this court should and could affirm the district court's decision granting summary judgment, at least in part, to the plaintiffs, even in light of the Hess affidavit. First of all, the defendant and the court was correct to note that this affidavit was brought in response and was mentioned and only cursorily discussed. The point now raised by the defendant, AFNI, in its appellate reply brief, that this fact should somehow be deemed admissible or at least go to the jury because of the defendant's because of the plaintiff's response to the proposed finding of fact that relates to this affidavit. That's a discretionary call on the district court as to how to treat the proposed finding of fact. It's our position that the district court did not oversee this affidavit or somehow miss it, rather saw through it or saw it for what it was, a very vague.
Well, he would have certainly mentioned it. You mean he knew about it, but he didn't mention it? Is that what you're trying to argue?
I'm saying that it was such a minimal or de minimis part or point of AFNI's briefing and arguments in theory at the district court.
Why shouldn't we just remand this case for a determination of what the costs of collection are?
For what the costs of the collection are?
Yeah.
Well, unless it somehow coincidentally will turn out that it's 15% on each one, on each account, even though AFNI is doing this exact same thing on each account. So I don't know how it could, which means that the cost should be the same thing. It won't matter because they're not assessing actual costs. Unless it coincidentally somehow turns out that the actual collection cost on each account is 15% of the balance, which means it could vary from $16 or less to $190 or more. There's no AFNI's just putting in the 15% is not an actual or permissible cost because it's not actual cost or actual incidental or actual consequential damages.
Well, I guess what I want to get back to is what I started out with Mr. Hannes as well. If this had been a fee transaction, then AFNI could have done the collection on the singular accounts, could have charged its customer, singular, 15%, I suppose, of any account submitted to it as a fee, and that would have complied with the law. Would you agree with that?
Most likely.
It looks like the contract language contemplates that, so the under contract.
Yes, and there's case, there's case law, at least somewhat to that effect, both in this circuit and in other courts, whether you're talking about collection fees or attorney's costs. But that's
right. And so what you seem to be saying is that AFNI's actually trying to have it both ways, that they're the assignee of these debts. They aren't just some third party collector. And yet they're also now trying to assess the fees. And it's not in the contract that way, number one. And it's also more than the law would the relevant law would permit, since it doesn't correspond to actual cost.
That is correct, and that's not how Wisconsin law works. That's not how the common law of incidental or consequential damages, or the cases cited by AFNI to that effect. The few Wisconsin state court cases cited to that effect, now in its appellate brief, are cases where there was a breach of an employment contract, and the employer then had incidental or consequential damages as a result of having to quickly hire someone to fill the spot by the breaching employee, or where there was consequential damages as a result of lost profit when a contractor breached its duties or breached its contract to fulfill a building.
I should say a word about the bona fide error defense, because that's AFNI's backup, that even if we did do the wrong thing, we were trying to check to see what was what these various state laws did, and this was just a bona fide mistake of law, and that ought to be included in the bona fide error.
I'm trying to keep at least this statement brief, because I would like to address, I don't want to say our backup plan, but I would like to address the Wisconsin Consumer Act and its relevance to this case. Essentially, with the bona fide error claim, as concerns the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, they had to have made a genuine mistake, and it has to have been, in spite of the defendants having had reasonable practices in place, reasonably adapted to avoid this mistake. I think one passage from the district court's opinion referencing AFNI's email to the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, which is the regulatory body charged with oversight of the Wisconsin Consumer Act. There was an email sent by AFNI to a person at the Department of Financial Institutions after this lawsuit was initiated, in which they were seeking some clarification or seeking a result in their favor prior to, you know, some result in the district court action in this case, in which they essentially said in the email and in the response from the DFI is in the record that they don't really see where this is permissible, and they were looking for, you know, some clarification or guidance now. But, you know, as far as a bona fide error is concerned, if a debt collector were to come forward and say, look, we had, you know, here's some correspondence where we tried, where we made an effort, where we did a little research, such as the case as far as the reliance that was involved in the court opinion decided by this case, or such was the case in Johnson versus Riddle, which is another bona fide error for debt collection practices, that case, I believe, in the Tenth Circuit, where there was actual, you know, research to make a good faith effort, which is what bona fide means, then they could have a leg to stand on, really, with the bona fide error. They might have a leg to stand on. They would still be essentially having to say, well, yeah, our view was that we could pay ourselves, you know, that we were having it both ways, and that was somehow reasonable. And the district court was correct to say that's just not a reasonable view, especially in light of the fact that you sent this email after the fact, and especially, you know, you didn't contact the DFI formally or informally just to get information when you decided to be doing this in Wisconsin. You didn't contact a Wisconsin attorney or even review all of these form contracts to look at the language to see what they permitted. That's what would be bona fide.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, if you wanted to make one more point, you're running low on time.
Thank you. I do. This case was brought under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act as well as the Wisconsin Consumer Act. Plaintiffs contend that the district court erred in dismissing their Wisconsin Consumer Act claim because claiming that the cellular service contracts in question were not consumer credit transactions. The only issue here before this court on that is whether or not, in terms of the definition of what a consumer credit transaction is whether or not these were payable on installments.
Now, does this change your – I mean, you can't get more relief without a cross appeal. If this is an alternative ground that you're suggesting to support the judgment, that's fine.
That we've argued throughout, and it's an alternative ground to support the judgment. Absolutely not. Nothing, it would not be alternative relief. And so under Bennett and other Seventh Circuit and United States Supreme Court precedents, that's allowed, as opposed to the cases cited by AFNI, which says that, yeah, we couldn't seek more or further or greater relief, and we are not. So the installment contracts, the cellular service contracts, these people, there's early termination fees. They are for 12 or 24 months of service, and they have to pay every month. Now, how much they pay every month has a minimum. I see I'm out of time.
Out of time. If you want to just wrap up very quickly that last thought, we will let you do that.
This case, just for insightfulness, is essentially analogous to the Milwaukee Alarm case, Wisconsin court that actually looked, appellate court case that actually looked at the Wisconsin Consumer Act on this issue, and it's relevant on all significant aspects if one looks at just the base cellular service contract.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Mather.
Thank you.
We still have a few minutes. How much time? 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to follow up on one of the first questions that the court directed to the appellee's counsel. One of the questions was, who has the burden to respond to the Hess affidavit once that affidavit is introduced? Are local rules in the Eastern District of Wisconsin directly and specifically address that question? The local rules permitted AFNI in opposing the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment to submit additional proposed findings of fact, supported by evidentiary fact, such as affidavits, deposition transcripts, all those things that constitute evidentiary fact. The local rules further provide that the moving party can respond to those additional proposed findings of fact, but it must do so with evidentiary fact, such as affidavits, deposition transcripts, and those sorts of things that we understand to constitute evidentiary fact. The plaintiffs responded to our proposed finding of fact, setting forth that verbiage from Mr. Hess's affidavit with an objection and a sort of general assertion in the negative that that it wasn't sufficient. There were no deposition transcripts cited, despite the fact that the plaintiffs had full and fair opportunity to take Mr. Hess's deposition. There were no opposing affidavits cited and no other evidence.
After he created that affidavit, they were able to take his deposition?
They took his deposition before moving for summary judgment and had full and fair opportunity, I think, to question him on any subject.
He hadn't said in his deposition what he said in the affidavit, or you would have cited to the deposition.
True, but I don't.
When did they have a chance to depose him after he created that affidavit?
Not after the affidavit, but they had the opportunity to take his deposition and to ask him any questions that they saw fit. So my point is that the local rules do direct that the district court is then to take that fact as uncontroverted. And I don't think it's discretionary. I believe that the local rules use the word must. If the proposed findings of fact is supported by an affidavit and there is no proper response in accordance with local rules, the local rules direct the district court to take it as uncontroverted. So as far as that fact is concerned, I believe that it is an uncontroverted material fact, and I believe that it creates a question of fact for the jury under the Tuttle v. Equifax case. And frankly, the district court appears to have missed it in its lengthy memorandum decision granting summary judgment to the plaintiffs. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case.